I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today on Change Surfer, we're listening to the second part of a panel entitled Cyborgs, Afterman, and Beyond that was held at the Boston Science Fiction Convention, Boscone, on February the 19th, 2006. On the panel are Cory Doctorow, Robert Katz, Carl Schroeder, Charlie Strauss, and Alicia Kestrel-Verlager, and yours truly. To hear the first part of this panel, download the MP3 from IEET.org.
Vinci's new book, we've talked about it a lot at this con. It's coming out soon. Those of us who are extremely hep to the jive have got advanced looks at it. And it's called Rainbow's End, and one of the components of that is that the user interfaces are all adaptive. And Charlie, I would have asked you if you consider an adaptive algorithm in a cochlear implant self-healing prosthesis. And because they're all adaptive, literally your computer works different from someone else's, and you have to, and you can't really... You can't share tips with people. You can't say, oh, have you tried this shortcut yet? Because your UI is different. So your cognitive enhancer, your outboard brain, behaves differently depending on how good you are at training it. They call it learning to wear. You learn to wear your computer.
I'm mad at him because he's stolen a whole bunch of things I was going to put in the mining.
Is that an interesting aspect, I think, about prosthetics is that when I talk about prosthetics to my science fiction friends, I use the word prosthetic, and a lot of them think of their PDAs, their glasses, the various tools, they use, cell phones they use every day. In the mainstream, this is a radical idea, but it does come down to the idea, the way people use their PDAs, which are basically disposable. I have, people get a PDA, they get the tools they want on it, it stops doing everything they want it to do, and they get another PDA. And I think that's one of the ways that prosthetics and tools blur on that line, where we start thinking of our prosthetics as being disposable, totally upgradable, and able to be personalized.
Following that idea a bit further, the first category of prosthetics that the human species started coming up with... is there anyone in this room who isn't wearing a pair of shoes? Okay. Or clothing? You know, I mean, we're living in an environment that our ancestors would have not been well adapted to back 50,000 years ago, Paleolithic era.
And vice versa.
Clothing is, I guess, a prosthetic enhancement for allowing us to survive in non-tropical climates. The footwear we're wearing is mostly designed to allow us to walk on terrain that isn't really... the stuff that our feet were adapted for.
Sure.
This is why it becomes interesting to think of the devices as existing outside the body, as enhancements. For instance, buildings are enhancements. They're enhancements to the body. Streets are enhancements to the body. Swimming pools are enhancements to the body. The fact that we've categorized them differently, conceptualized them differently,
you wrote a book, Carl, in which human beings evolve or have the potential to evolve to build spaceships the way that beavers build dams.
Yeah. It's part of the whole argument that intelligence is ultimately unnecessary, or consciousness, rather, which Peter Watts has trumped everybody with in his new novel, Blindsight.
There's a question in the audience.
I just wonder, when you start talking about prosthetics and tools in terms of shoes and clothing, how infinitely reducible is that? Like, aren't spears prosthetics, or fire prosthetic? I mean, how...
This is Andy Clark's
a meaningful discussion anymore? Haven't we been cyborgs since we stopped just using our teeth?
Well, yeah, exactly. But you compare us to any other animal. Any of the things that we do, these are all extensions.
How about beavers?
Dogs are prosthetics.
Like, is a dam a prosthetic? Well, we found a prosthetic.
Well, it's the whole question of what technology is.
We found tool use in primates and other animals. So, I think that's an important, very important point. Not only is tool use not a specifically human characteristic, but it is this, you know, eons long process of which our current prosthetics are just one more step. And so, again, from the point of view of whether your fiction revolves around, oh my God, we've now crossed this terrible line because we've stuck something in our head or in our body or in our leg, you know, that is historically and phenomenologically not the appropriate approach to it, really. It should be that there's this continuity of human technological progress.
Yeah, what counts as technology and what counts as you is really a matter of perspective. It has a lot to do with usage and the ability to discard, but it's not even that cut and dry.
Yeah, but that reasoning, fingernails aren't you, because you can discard them.
Exactly. It blurs. It really blurs. And the cells in your body, there's the argument that, in fact, your body is technology used by your genetic code to propagate itself.
Okay.
A neat thing we can take a stab at, thanks to Moore's Law. You can make a back-of-the-envelope estimate of the sensory bandwidth of the human brain, how much data is coming into a human brain per second. You should be able to pretty much encode it in roughly 100 megabytes per second. You know, we know roughly how many rod and cone cells there are in a human retina. We know roughly how many sensory nerves there are elsewhere in the body. We know roughly how long depolarization takes. Now, the amount of data storage we've got is going up and up and up, and we can actually also put a figure on the maximum amount of data storage we can easily get. Before you start having to use data compression, you can probably store one bit per atom in a diamond lattice fairly easily. So you get about Avogadro's number of bits per molar weight, or I think it works out at something like 10 to the 18 bytes per gram of carbon polymer. Now, compared to the actual sensory bandwidth there, the total amount of data going into you, the total amount of data that influences your proprioceptive environment over your entire life, can be encoded in just a few grams of carbon. And we're not that far away from being able to encode all that. I mean, I'm currently carrying around at least two digital cameras and a few gigabytes of storage. Extrapolate a few years down the line, I'll be carrying around lots more cameras, probably cameras built into my glasses, and several terabytes of storage. Go another decade down the line, and at that point you're into the exabyte range and full sensory monitoring of everything coming into me, which can also be tagged by location via GPS and related technologies, tagged by comment if I just want to remind my second memory as to where I am or why something is of interest, and made searchable. At this point, we're looking at, effectively, a prosthetic memory. And the interesting thing about the prosthetic memory is the human being behind it might sort of drop dead, but the memory doesn't.
That's right. Yeah, no, sure.
In fact, the memory can be shared.
Jimmy Cassio runs a website called worldchanging.org, which I highly recommend. It's about sustainable technology. And he wrote an essay recently called Participatory Panopticon, where he projects this kind of a future where we're recording all of our experiences in high digital resolution. And then he moves into Corey's space, and he says, what happens then when you go to a movie and your glasses have recorded for your own amusement later a digital copy of the movie, but the movie company says, no, you're not allowed to do that because that's going to violate our digital rights management. How will we be able to have control over our own memory if we don't have a kind of general consensual agreement that we get to record our own lives in this kind of digital resolution?
Well, yeah, not to mention, which is the building that you weren't able to take photographs of last year?
The Bean in Chicago is a sculpture. There are a lot of buildings, too, but the Bean is a public sculpture in Chicago.
Right, so if you're walking by that and you cannot, potentially you cannot memorize it, but potentially you cannot even perceive it anymore.
Yeah, and Carl, you wrote another book in which this is the case, in which rights you paid for determines which elements of your sensory you're allowed to turn on.
Yeah, yeah, I'd like to just add my next SF novel is set about 500 years after Accelerando, and we have a sort of post-human society. There's an archaeology project, a practical archaeology project, trying to recreate Dark Ages life, the Dark Ages being sort of 1950 through 2040, and they know very little about that period. they've got sort of lots of duplicated, rather fuzzy reruns of I Love Lucy, but not a lot of later stuff. Because the later stuff was all locked up on media, which decayed before they could be effectively decrypted and freed.
Yeah, one of the issues with, for instance, fixing the human genome and stabilizing it over the long term is the idea of having the genome downloaded into some kind of computer form. But if you think about it, that's a more volatile form than the original. The original encoding that you carry around in our bodies actually lasts for millions of years at a time, right? What happens when your genetic code is actually stored by Google or somebody and the servers go there?
I'm going to argue that the perceived volatility of computer storage is actually an artifact of the speed with which it's evolving and also of the capitalist society that's developing it, but it's very much seen as a consumer technology. We can envisage digital memory storage constructs that are sort of stable across billions of years.
Yeah.
Take a diamond. Each carbon atom in the diamond represents a bit, be it a 0 or a 1. Carbon-12 nuclei represent a 0, carbon-13 represent a 1. You use nanoassemblers to build this stuff up, and this is going to be stable across geological time. Unfortunately, it's in nobody's commercial interest to start selling memory like this, because, let's face it, it's like the Victorian pram manufacturers of London who all went out of business because they were making baby prams that lasted for 100 years.
So, I hear what you're saying, Charlie, but, I mean, how do you resolve the tension between the idea that storage increases in this exponentiating curve and obsolescence? Because presumably we do what I do, which is I buy a computer that's merely a half step out from the computer that I've got today, and it has twice as much storage, and so I import everything. I've got logo programs I wrote in 1979 and an Apple II Plus in my PowerBook.
There's a very, very simple but relatively unpalatable answer, which is the current form of consumer capitalism will have to be replaced by something else. I'm not making a bid for traditional communism here. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that the current capitalist system is not stable.
So that part I get, but what I'm saying is, how do you end up with a dark age? I mean, presumably we can't read the zip cartridges. Presumably there is something about the zip cartridges that's lost when you just save the data off the zip cartridges. I mean, there's the tacticality, there's whatever was scrawled on the label and so on.
You have a stack of 100 of them, you forget to transcribe 2 of them. Repeat for 30 to 50 generations, and you've lost most of it.
Is that more of a forgettery than you have when you with substrate that turns to ash and that isn't replaced by substrate on an 18-month cycle that's twice as capacious?
I'm not sure. I think the jury is still out on a lot of this.
Like, I think the Internet Archive is going to be distributing marble-sized $1 storage units with copies of the web, daily copies of the web from 1996 to date N, that will have, for example, trillions of stored live journal equivalent entries that will record a palimpsest of everyday life that today we can only recover from the occasional shipping log or personal journal, and generally speaking, only of the most literate classes. I mean, we don't know much, for example, about how the working class lived in previous eras, because oftentimes the working class was illiterate or lacked archival substrate.
There's a secondary problem of this, though, which is that what you're talking about being recorded is not necessarily the truth about how they lived, but how they thought they lived. There's a big difference here. It's the observer thing.
Today on Change Surfer, we're listening to the second part of a panel that was held at BOSCON, the Boston Science Fiction Convention. The panel was titled Cyborgs, After Man, and Beyond. And on the panel are Cory Doctorow, Robert Katz, Carl Schroeder, Charlie Strauss, Alicia Kestrel-Verlager, and yours truly.
I found very provocative John C. Wright's Golden Age series, and it begins with the idea that everyone has collectively decided to forget something. Which reflects a common bioconservative idea that any kind of modulation of human memory will lead to various kinds of disasters, whether we have the ability to intentionally forget things or have the ability to remember everything. I think there are some interesting questions there. I mean, for instance, the importance to our relationships with each other of our ability to forget past slights. You know, if you always have a high-fidelity recording of your wife calling you an idiot or whatever, it may be much more difficult to move on and to have the kind of relationships that we have now. But I also have a faith that we'll figure out some way around that, and it may be intentionally deciding to forget some things like that.
And yet the cornerstone of cognitive therapy is to write down how you feel and what circumstances lead to it, because having a memory prosthetic, to return to cyborgianism, having a memory prosthetic actually helps you make sense of your environment when your perception goes off the rails.
Yes.
So what happens in the not-so-distant future when a congressional inquiry says, what happened on the night of the 17th? And the witness says, I don't remember. And he's absolutely correct because he took a drug last night that wiped out exactly the memory of the 17th.
Well, it might not. That's right.
That sounds like the plot of a novel. That's the plot of a novel about the Magic Kingdom.
It's actually a novel. There's another novel on that nature, Peter F. Hamilton's latest thing, Pandora's Star. It's a 900-page doorstep with a very nice 250-page thriller, crime novel, struggling to get out. And, you know, the murder plot in that crime novel, you've just described it.
But again, that's in a continuity with all kinds of memory erasure that comes before it. I mean, if you burn the letters that get indicted for, you know, that subpoenaed by the court, if you destroy the emails that got subpoenaed, the financial records, it's exactly the same issue. It's just moved into a different media.
If you drank your life away after the love of your life left you in the lurch.
That's right. I don't know if that one's ever gotten to court, but that's an interesting one.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about memory, if you're talking about crimes, witnesses are notoriously unreliable. People's memory of events, it changes almost instantly after the real event happens. I don't think that we're postulating anything new here. We might be talking about volitional changes in memory and volitional loss of memory rather than natural and artificial and by chance loss of memory.
So the cyborgian enhancement that I would like more than anything else right now, given I've had a very fraught relationship with my body, which is that I was much heavier than I am now, and used a fairly radical form of dieting to lose a lot of weight, but which wasn't very sustainable, is I would love to and I'm a foodie, and I'm a complete excessive food junkie, and I would love to have the ability to selectively instruct my body as to which nutrients were intended to be stored and which ones should just be passed. And say, yeah, I'm going to have that Ben and Jerry's, but I'd just like you not to retain it. You know, I've grown up with Carl. Carl and I have known each other since I was about 16. And Carl, of course, is if he doesn't eat enough, if he doesn't have the occasional bowl of ice cream, his ribs start poking out. So.
Well, I think the control of obesity is clearly going to be one of the killer apps for human enhancement. I mean, if any effective fat pill comes on the market, it's going to be so universally popular that no biocon will be able to stand in the way.
Not only that, but if we're looking at it as broader metabolism, it seems fairly obvious that you can do a lot by tweaking your mitochondria, the cellular power stations in effect, that do the burning of energy. And you know what? There's a lot of current research suggesting that mitochondrial DNA malfunctions are what lead to an awful lot of the aging process.
Right.
So, you know, it's not only going to actually get rid of the spare tire, it's also going to make you feel rather young again. And, you know, it's not going to be an orderly queue.
Yes.
So that Methuselah fruit fly guy says that at 90, senescence stops. So if you can actually reach 90 in pretty good shape, you apart from you sort of the lightning strikes of cancer and heart attacks, will enjoy a relatively agile dotage. And I wonder what that means in respect of our choices of prostheses and medical procedures. You know, would we favor a therapy for obesity that brought on senescence at 70 instead of 90, and then doomed us to a very long and unhealthy life after 90, because when we hit 90, we weren't in very good shape? Or would we be willing to sort of look at the kind of time value of money or the time value of labor so rationally, so far out, and say, you know, we're going to give up, we're gonna enhance or enforce discipline in ourselves in order to reach 90 in better shape? Like my doctor, when I gave up cigarettes, said, you're 30 years old, you can't give up smoking for your health, because not getting cancer in 40 years is not a health benefit, right? It won't make you feel better tomorrow to not get cancer in 40 years.
Was he advocating you to continue smoking?
No. He said you needed to find a motivation for giving up smoking that isn't your health. For me, it was no longer spending 2 power books a year on corporations whose mission was to kill me and pervert science.
I mean, we human beings tend to be really, really bad at calculating forward risk or probability, especially in the long term rather than the short term. So Corey's got a good point there. Most people won't do that, at least not without very immediate payoff.
Mm-hmm. There's a question over there.
More of a comment. A drug similar to what Corey just described was, I remember hearing in high school, banned in the 1920s, what it did was to decouple sugar metabolism from production of ATP, which is what cells actually use for energy. And, you know, I mean, it worked wonderfully. You could eat tons of stuff and not get fat. In fact, you could eat tons of stuff and starve yourself to death, which is why it got bad.
Well, people have radical intestinal surgery to reduce the efficiency with which they metabolize. Or today, it's a contemporary treatment for obesity, sometimes inadvertent, sometimes as a consequence of trauma, but often as an option, a radical therapy, last hope therapy for people who are morbidly obese.
Mm-hmm. I would add one thing, though. Don't discount the possibility that a lot of the received wisdom on a given medical condition is wrong. I'm going to draw attention in the first instance to stomach ulcers, which for a long time were sort of associated with stress.
Right.
Acid heartburn, no, it turns out there's a bacterial infection behind it. Something I read about recently, and I want to actually find a bit more out about this, is the obesity epidemic isn't just restricted to the developed world. There's quite a lot of third world countries where people began getting fat at the same time. And there is a strong suggestion that there's a family of viruses that infect both birds, like chickens, and humans. And you know what? If you've got this, you have a subclinical infection, and the main side effect is you get fat.
Actually, if you go back to Robert Ettinger's Man into Superman, he was the guy who started the cryonics movement, and he wrote a cyborg manifesto of his own in 1971, Man into Superman. One of the things he was really excited about was the redesign of the human digestive tract to cure diseases such as obesity, and then 20 years later, of course, it becomes a very popular surgery for the morbidly obese. It has many side effects and consequences for the people who do it. And I think one of the things that both transhumanists and biocons are insufficiently attentive to is that we have regulatory processes in place already to determine the safety of medicines and therapies. And, you know, those are inadequate, and they're dominated by corporate decision-making, and when Republicans are in power, they all go to crap. But we need to reinforce the already democratic and deliberative mechanisms that we have for ensuring that we all collectively don't kill each other trying to get to paradise. And once we do that, then that becomes a much more interesting question than whether we should ban something or universally worship it.
What I find interesting is the question of the long-term effect of these things. I'm talking, future of the species. I mean, look at wildebeests. Why aren't they poisonous to lions? You would think that, you know, if nature is really all about, survival, that they would sprout thorns on their backs, they would become poisonous, they're in fact integrated into the lion wildebeest system. They're supposed to be eaten, right? We are supposed to have a lot of the ailments and problems that we have because we're part of a system. When we stop being part of a system, there's no guarantee that we will be fit enough to survive. Making ourselves stronger does not make us fitter as a species. Making ourselves more intelligent does not necessarily make us more fit.
And yet the system changes constantly.
It does change constantly, which means that you are always dealing with what's fit right now, not...
Right.
So there is no such thing as a trait that is inherently fit. Intelligence is not inherently fit. It is only fit right now in a given circumstance.
Well, all the lions who have who are susceptible to wildebeest venom die, and their children survive and eat the remaining wildebeest
right.
and thrive, right?
Yeah.
But what I think a lot of people do when talking about this sort of thing is make an assumption that certain things are inherently fit. Smarter is inherently fit, right? Stronger, longer life, these are inherently fit. But that's not the case. There is nothing that is inherently fit. So we have no idea whether the enhanced humans or transhumans that replace us will be fitter to survive, because it is always a question about the particular circumstances that they're in.
I think the idea is that intelligence is a universal adaptation.
But there is no reason to think that. If you look at the fossil record,
mm-hmm.
Exactly 50% of the time, the successful species is smarter than the last one. 50% of the time,
smarter species survives 50% of the time, dumber species survives.
Feeding the brain is expensive.
Yeah, and that goes back all the way through the fossil record. So, in fact, intelligence appears to be neutral to the survival of the species as a general rule.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
I have a question for Jay.
Jay Hughes, yeah.
About what you were saying earlier, I'd like to hear whoever wants to respond to that, about the bioconservative fiction versus more openly transhumanist fiction. And it's interesting to me that something that appears to be bioconservative might still be of value to a transhumanist movement in the way that, you know, fiction has long had this role of being, forget if I'm quoting Picard or someone, a moral laboratory, that it's actually really, it could be potentially very important to the advancement of a transhumanist agenda to sort of have this, to have a body of fiction that investigates potentially what could go wrong in the pursuance of that, because it's pretty unpredictable about how this could go down, market factors and health factors and things like that. And I just wondered if you or anyone else wants to comment on a fiction writer's role in, you know, in being transhumanist, but still potentially doing, playing with the politics and the economics of what could potentially go wrong in an openly transhumanist.
I think that's an absolutely pertinent question, because I think, you know, we had a panel on utopias on Friday night, and one of the reasons why we look back at these utopias and see that, you know, they're not really interesting either as speculative fiction or as political project is because they don't take into account any of the downsides, conflicts, differences of opinion, things like that. And I'm a firm believer in the Cyberpunk Manifesto from the 80s, which is that the role is not to adulate some kind of ideal future or the perfection of technologies to come, but it's also not to denigrate and treat as horrific the notion of any kind of technological change. It's to paint a realistic idea of what it might be like to live in that kind of a future and how people might actually deal with problems of inequality or safety regulation or all the different problems that might raise. So yes, I think, you know, there are many transhumanists who are drawn to transhumanism because of their unbridled techno-utopianism and need to have that, you know, kind of check on their imagination. But by the way, we do give the H.G. Wells Award, and he's an exemplar of this because he imagined both utopian and dystopian futures.
But if you're talking about fiction, let's not forget that the primary purpose of fiction is to entertain. And all that we're talking about here really is the background of a story that might entertain us.
But just to follow that up for a second, in 150 years ago, Mark Twain and Harry Beecher Stowe wrote, Mark Twain wrote his stuff and Harry Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and, you know, both of them in their own way humanized African Americans and for Northern whites and helped to inspire the abolitionist movement. I'm not saying that every speculative fiction writer has a moral responsibility to engage in political struggle through their work, but you know, to the extent that you become aware that we're in a time where there are these pervasive bioconservative hostility to life extension and to cyberbiological enhancement and to cognitive liberty, I think you do have to be self-aware if you use that as the MacGuffin of your story to say, oh my God, Lawnmower Man, some guy tries to get more intelligent and tries to take over the world, and that's a terrible idea. Well, you know, people getting smarter isn't necessarily the end of the world.
If the primary purpose of fiction is to entertain, why hasn't it been overtaken by tickle fights?
I'd actually like to add...
because they're not that entertaining.
I'm very doubtful that the original purpose of science fiction, as sort of in the Gernsbach-y tradition, was to entertain. Go back to the 1920s and, if you will, read up on technocracy, the technocracy political movement. Gernsback was fairly clearly involved in it. The technocrats believed in a rational society ruled by engineers with slide rules who would work out the mathematically correct, valid way to run society. It was sort of a modernist era movement. It fell by the wayside. It was overtaken by communism. It was overtaken by fascism. That sort of large-scale social engineering got a very bad name for itself, and it petered out. But at the time when it was sort of near its peak of interest, you had the great flowering of the American pulp SF magazines in the Golden Age, And I generally tend to look on science fiction as being sort of the agitprop, Goebbels-inspired arm of the technocrat movement, but has outlived the original political movement, and indeed is now written by people, most of whom have never heard of it.
Today on Change Surfer, we've been listening to the second part of a panel entitled Cyborgs, After Man and Beyond, that was held at Boscone, the Boston Science Fiction Convention. On the panel were Cory Doctorow, Robert Katz, Carl Schroeder, Charlie Strauss, Alicia Kestrel-Verlager, and yours truly, Dr. J. To hear the first part of this panel, go to IEET.org and download the MP3. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.